Thank you. I know. I'm the last speaker. We're behind. No clinical stuff. You want to keep looking, that's fine. But follow along, I'll tell you a cool story. So, my disclosure is an objective. So, we were shocked when we found out that 57% of patients with lupus nephritis present with zero symptoms whatsoever. So what do? Patient come to clinic, we have to screen for proteinuria at every visit, and then we react with the kidney biopsy if the proteinuria is above a certain threshold. We kind of agree that 500 is a good number. There's more data, but let's agree on 500 for now. And then we get a biopsy and we treat based with the guidance of what we find on biopsy. But there are limitations to this approach. Proteinuria does not differentiate between classes. It does not correlate with inflammation in the kidney. You need to have a degree of kidney damage by the time you get proteinuria. And importantly, it does not distinguish treatable inflammation from chronic damage. And this is the annual reminder that proteinuria does not correlate with intrarenal activity at diagnosis. This is why we need to biopsy. And just be mindful that in patients with lupus and proteinuria less than 500, you have a 30% chance, if you biopsy them, to find proliferative lupus nephritis. And if they have microhematuria, 85% chance of finding at least a class 3. So how does it perform when you look after treatment? So in this study, everyone with lupus nephritis got treated with mycophenolate for at least 6 months. They repeated the kidney biopsy per protocol. And they, in the patients that achieved a proteinuria goal of less than 500 after 6 months, the biopsy showed that 50% of them still had significant histological activity, and the opposite was also true, that in patients who achieved complete histological remission, 60% of them still had proteinuria greater than 500. So what should we do? We should just biopsy everyone every so often. And in fact, these studies are showing that the initial biopsy is not a good prognostic indicator of how well the patient is going to do. So the second biopsy is the good one. So if you need the biopsy, just get the second one. This is what some authors say. And that's because 90% of repeat biopsy actually lead to change in treatment. But of course, you know, just biopsy a patient every few months is impractical, has contraindication. But also the biopsy, a diagnosis sometimes cannot be obtained right away when you need it. It's invasive and it can delay diagnosis and treatment. So we need better biomarkers, especially if they are tied to pathophysiology. They can tell us, if they reflect tissue biology, they can guide treatment in real time. So this was how we tackled this issue. We developed this proteomic pipeline in which we took more than 200 patients with lupus nephritis at time of diagnosis, and we got a urine sample before diagnosis. And then again, after 3, 6, and 12 months of treatment, and we quantified 1,200 urinary proteins to find biomarkers of disease. Urine, because it's downstream of the kidneys, and it collects information from both kidneys, not just the little piece of tissue that you get with a kidney biopsy, is the ideal sample specimen to actually sample the biology of the kidney. So the first question we asked was, what are the proteomic signatures of the different lupus nephritis classes? And just to remind everyone, we can oversimplify kidney histology into two major groups. Proliferative, which are the class 3 and 4, it means that there is more inflammation inside the glomeruli, more aggressive, higher risk of damage over time, and membranous at the bottom, where you have thickening of the glomerular basal membrane, more pink, and less inflammation inside the glomeruli. So the first thing we ask is that, okay, well, let's compare proliferative versus healthy just to get the baseline. So this is a volcano plot. Each dot is a protein. If it's on the right, it means that it was enriched in the urine of patients with pure proliferative disease. If it's on the left, the comparator is healthy control, so it means it was lower in lupus. The y-axis is the negative log of the p-value, so the higher, the more statistically significant. So all the proteins you see within that circle are the proteins enriched in proliferative lupus nephritis. And to make biological sense, we did path enrichment analysis, and we found that leukocytes, so inflammation, cellular inflammation, neutrophil degranulation, were the pathway enriched, not surprisingly, in patients with more immune infiltration in the kidney. But we also found evidence of extracellular matrix disassembly, suggesting that we can measure in real time ongoing damage to the kidney. Let me just skip this one for sake of time. So then you can say, well, sure, lupus patient and proteinuria, they have a different signature. But let's go to the important question. Can you separate lupus, like class 4 from class 5, for example? So, and this is a comparison of any proliferative lupus nephritis, so class 3 and 5, class 3 and 4 versus the others. And this is the signature that was specific to the patient with proliferative disease. And there were a few biomarkers, such as interleukin 16, CD163, that were kind of famous and important. But all the protein that you see circled in red, these are found inside the granules of neutrophils. And pathway enrichment analysis showed that neutrophil degranulation was the main signature that characterized lupus nephritis. So what is the signature of histological activity, which is the number that goes from 0 to 24 that we kind of value when we get the biopsy back? We wanted to see if there was a dose response to this effect. And these are two volcano plots. This time are showing the correlation with the NIH activity index. So the proteins in pink and on the right are those that positively correlate with histological activity. So the higher inflammation in the inflammation in the kidney, the higher the concentration in the urine. And in these two cohorts, interleukin 16 came out as the protein that most correlated with histological activity, and that was followed by CD163 and many others. So the many others, and I'm sorry this is not showing correctly, but the many others were, again, the neutrophil granules, so the protein that we found in neutrophils, and pathway enrichment showed the neutrophil degranulation was the main signature correlating with activity. And that you see at the top is PR3. Wait a minute, I know PR3, I heard that before, but it's in a different disease. What is it doing here? And so we said, well, let's go and take a look. And then we looked at, this is a biopsy of a lupus patient, and we stained for PR3 and MPO, and then we were mesmerized. It lighted up as a starry night, and we found plenty of these cells in the kidney. So we are now studying them to see how can we target these cells, because clearly they correlate with activity, and clearly we can do something about it because they're causing damage. All right, to summarize the first part, urine proteomics can detect active biological pathways in nephritis, and pure membranous and proliferative, I didn't show that, but they both share a signature of matrix remodeling, telling us that even membranous, if we think is more benign, actually is affecting the kidney in a structural way. Active proliferative lupus nephritis is characterized by neutrophil degranulation, and interleukin 16, which is a pro-inflammatory molecule, is linked to lupus nephritis and is a potentially a new target and is also a promising biomarker. So I'm a clinician. So like you, I want something that I can use in practice. And so we ask, I really want a biomarker that could predict if the patient in front of me is going to respond to treatment, and even better, to which treatment. And so we ask, which are the proteins at baseline that can predict response? And what a disappointment. There was nothing, zero, flat line. It couldn't be more negative than this. So these are the proteins on the right that are increased at baseline in patients who would respond at 1 year, and on the left, those who, in the non-responders, there was no difference. And so we started thinking, well, some of my patients are responding to treatment. Some other are not responding to treatment because I know at 1 year they're going to do better. And we are giving them immunosuppression. So that immunosuppression is doing something. It must be perturbing the system in the kidney, and we should see a biological response to that. And so we said, well, listen, let's look at 3 months. Let's look at what has changed in the people who eventually will respond to treatment as compared to those who did not respond to treatment. And this is what we found. We found that in the patients who ultimately were classified as non-responders, there were no changes after 3 months of treatment. But in those who eventually responded to treatment, there was a significant reduction in a number of protein that are those indicated in pink in the graph on the right. And if you remember, these are the same proteins that are correlated with histological activity. And this is telling us that the effective immunosuppression is reducing histological activity, which is resulting in this mirrored reduction of these proteins of inflammation in the urine, and that can be measured in real time, and we can predict at 3 years, at 3 months, who's going to respond at 1 year. And are these good biomarkers? Now, this volcano plot here is plotting now the AUC, the area under the curve, which is a measurement of how accurate a predictor is. And this is at 3 months, the ability of these biomarkers at 3 months to predict response at 1 year, as compared to UPCR, so urine protein to creatinine ratio, which is our gold standard. And all the proteins in the blue circle are those that are outperforming proteinuria significantly. So we don't need a biomarker to just be as good as proteinuria because that would be useless. But now we have potential biomarkers that outperform our gold standard. So to summarize the second part, a decline of 3 months of urinary biomarkers of immunological response now best predicted 1 year response, especially in proliferative lupus nephritis. And treatment response is paralleled by a decrease in activity associated signatures. I didn't show that, but the signature of the granulation and matrix disassembly went down. And because these biomarkers of immunological response parallel intrarenal activity, they could detect early treatment responses and failure and then allow early treatment changes. These have an important role as surrogate endpoints in clinical trial, and I'll tell you more about that. Because the natural question becomes, should this biomarker now be the new treatment endpoint? Who cares about proteinuria if I have something better? So right now, the response in lupus nephritis is proteinuria-centric. And if you look at some examples in major trials and in the guidelines, they all hinge about, they focus on a reduction of proteinuria below a certain threshold after 3, 6, 12 months or 24 months. And there's a good reason for that. So Maria De Lera a few years ago took the patients from the Eurolupus trial and looked at the patients who at 7 years still maintained a creatinine less than 1. And so she asked, what is the proteinuria threshold at 1 year that best predict preservation of kidney function at 7 year? And what she found is that more or less 0.7, 0.8 is the best threshold for sensitivity and specificity, which is the rationale of why in belimumab, in the Blisalen trial, the goal was 0.7. But we just spent some time at the beginning showing how proteinuria is a very inaccurate measurement of response, meaning that a reduction in proteinuria does not correspond to a reduction of inflammation in the kidney. So what do we do when our gold standard is not the golden, when we have a bronze standard? And so we started thinking about, listen, we treat patients not to improve the proteinuria number. We treat lupus nephritis patients because we want to save their kidneys. We want to preserve their kidney function. We don't want this young girl end up on dialysis. And so we looked at the trajectories of their kidney function. So, and these are the trajectory of the kidney function of the GFR starting at 1, is normalized to basically everyone started at the same starting point in the lupus cohort. And we, over 5 years, and we found two groups of patients. One group that over 5 years, starting at the time of kidney biopsy, maintained their kidney function. And there was one group on the right that progressively lost kidney function. And what was shocking to learn is that a third of the patients who at 1 year were classified as complete responders continued to accrue progressive renal damage, meaning that they were in the second category. So even our definition of complete response is not a good predictor of preserving the kidney. And so we wanted to apply this concept to our biomarker study with the idea that let's find out now at 3 years who has maintain their kidney function and who has lost kidney function as a consequence of lupus nephritis. And let's see if our biomarkers can give us a better answer than proteinuria. And so we looked in a cohort, in the proteinuria cohort, and we were able to replicate the findings. We had a significant amount of patients that lost the GFR at 3 years, defined at either developing end-stage kidney disease, needing a kidney transplant or dialysis, or losing more than 15 ml of GFR in 3 years. And this is like data that are still coming in. So by now we have 92, and we had 36 patients that met the criterion of GFR loss at 3 years. And look at the bottom. 22% of patients that ended up losing significant kidney function were classified as complete or partial responders at 1 year. And so the hypothesis that we wanted to test is, if I have a biomarker of inflammation, of immunological activity in the kidney, in the urine. And my hypothesis is that the patients who lose kidney function over time lose it because I don't treat them good and well enough, and there is persistent inflammation in the kidney that is, you know, chewing on that matrix and is causing damage. Therefore, I would expect to see that after 6 or 12 months, there is persistent elevation of biomarker of histological activity. And so this is what happens with proteinuria at 6 months. So the group on the right is the group that lost GFR. The group on the left with the one with the stable GFR. And proteinuria had some predictive ability, but this is what happens with the other one. So, for example, interleukin 16, I just want to point out the AUC, the area under the curve, the maximum is 1. And it had a 83% prediction of the correct outcome at 6 months. But look at 12 months. At 12 months, proteinuria had an AUC of 76% as compared to an AUC of interleukin 16 of 88%. Is that something clinically meaningful? So this is comparing directly the performance in terms of sensitivity, specificity, PPV, NPV, and accuracy of interleukin 16 and proteinuria at 12 months. Sensitivity is much higher, specificity higher. Positive predictive value, negative predictive value, which is what we care about in the clinic, are significantly better for interleukin 16 as compared to proteinuria. The accuracy, which is how many times you guess it right, was 92% for interleukin 16 and 72% for UPCR. That means that when you make a prediction based on interleukin 16 at 12 months, you get the right prediction. You get the wrong prediction 88% of the time. Whereas when you use proteinuria, you are wrong 28% of the time. So 3.5 times more often. As clinician, we really like when we are right, but we really hate when we are wrong about the patient. And so if you look at the misclassification rate, you can see how a biomarker like this could really change the conversation and our ability to make the correct prediction. And of course, we want to combine them. This is nowhere near anything final, but just for, you know, to show friends and impress people. When you combine the three biomarkers together, the air under the curve is 96%, but we are working on a biomarker panel that could really be applied in practice, hopefully soon. So to summarize the last part, elevation of biomarkers of histological activity after 6 or 12 months of treatment predict GFR loss at 3 years better than proteinuria, especially interleukin 16. So insufficient immunosuppression likely results in persistent intrarenal immunological activity leading to kidney function loss. And because the ultimate treatment of lupus nephritis is long-term preservation of kidney function, clinical trial endpoints should include response definitions that best associate with GFR preservation, not just an improvement in proteinuria. And this is important because something like this, it means that we still have something treatable with immunomodulation, which is what we prescribe as a cornerstone of treatment to our patients. And these three patients were defined as complete responders, and yet they had a very high elevation of interleukin 16 after 1 year of immunosuppression. So this is my conclusion, and you know, just a look at the future on the horizon. So these biomarkers of these non-invasive urinary biomarkers of immunological activity paralleled intrarenal inflammation and predict future GFR, and they could be used to diagnose lupus nephritis non-invasively. They can monitor treatment response or failure, therefore allowing early treatment changes. They can help us deciding when to stop immunosuppression, 3, 5, 10 years, or when we basically, that can guide how fast or slow we can taper mycophenolate. They can serve as surrogate endpoints in clinical trials, and we are now working to see if they can detect lupus nephritis before the onset of proteinuria. And I want to put forward this concept that immunological responses are a better assessment than proteinuric responses. So I want to thank all my collaborators and the Accelerated Medicines Partnership, and if you have fellows interested in joining the Lupus Fellowship or doing research with us, please let me know. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this reprise session from Room Now Live 2024. This session and these recordings were sponsored by AbbVie, UCB, and Amgen. Be sure to register for Room Now Live 2025 when you can have full access to all the videos, all the recordings, all the downloads, and all the board questions that come out of Room Now Live 2025.